Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte, Washington. Today is Monday, September 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump is the target of another assassination attempt.
Two things have come together in the United States that really bode ill, and that is the prevalence of guns in this country. And the other phenomenon is the extreme political polarization in the United States.
Comoros Island President Assoumani is doing fine following Friday's knife attack on him. More than 500,000 people are seeking refuge in Nigeria's Borno state capital, Maiduguri. Meanwhile, Nigerian security agencies are hunting for dozens of escaped inmates from the flooded Maiduguri maximum security prison. South Sudan's government will brief diplomatic missions and UN agencies on Tuesday after extending the transitional period for elections.
The agenda for that meeting has not been put out in public, but what we could speculate is that this meeting is coming after a new event related to the extension of the transitional period.
And Uganda's Electoral Commission declined to register a political party aligned to former presidential aspirant Dr. Kizza Besigye. Those stories, plus Samson Omalley's sports, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. After former president and current Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump survived an assassination attempt that injured his ear at a campaign rally in Pennsylvania in July, the FBI says it is now investigating an apparent second assassination attempt on Trump on Sunday. White House correspondent Anita Powell reports.
For the second time in 9 weeks, former President Donald Trump walked away from a would-be assassination. The latest on Sunday afternoon at his golf club in West Palm Beach, Florida, the FBI said. Unlike the previous attempt, this one did not happen on live television, like the dramatic shooting Trump survived on July 13th. That attempt wounded Trump in the ear and killed a rally attendee behind him. Days later, Trump accepted the Republican Party's presidential nomination. Officials on Sunday said Trump was not hurt.
Former President Donald Trump is safe and unharmed.
The Federal Bureau of Investigation, which is leading the investigation, says it appears to be an attempted assassination. The local sheriff said the suspect fled, leaving behind an AK-47-style rifle with a scope, a GoPro camera, and two backpacks. Police later caught him as he sped along the main highway into a neighboring county. Sheriff Rick Bradshaw leads the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office.
The Secret Service agent that was on the course did a fantastic job. What they do is they have an agent that jumps one hole ahead of time to where the president was at. And he was able to spot this rifle barrel sticking out of the fence and immediately engage that individual, at which time the individual took off.
In a joint statement less than an hour after the Trump campaign announced this second attempt on Trump's life, President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris said they were being regularly briefed and said they are relieved that Trump is safe. The sheriff said the suspect was between 300 and 500 yards from Trump, hiding in shrubbery. And as Monday dawns and questions swirl in America about how this will add further uncertainty to an already tumultuous election, those simple numbers underscore a terrifying fact that a shooter managed to get so close to Trump, comfortably within the range of an AK-47-style rifle, about 330 yards, and that of an AR-15, often used in American mass shootings, which can kill at less than 600 yards. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump is safe after what the FBI said appeared to be an assassination attempt on Sunday while he was playing golf in West Palm Beach, Florida. He was not harmed. Samer Shihata is the Associate Professor of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He tells me the prevalence of guns and extreme political polarization are two contributing factors of political violence in the United States.
Well, unfortunately, two things have come together in the United States that really bode ill. And that is the prevalence of guns in this country. I think many people know that it's very easy to purchase a firearm, including assault weapons, and there are school shootings and mass shootings regularly. And the other phenomena, which has only occurred over the last decade or so, is the extreme political polarization in the United States, the demonization of the other political party, those who have different views from you, and so on, as being illegitimate, as being, you know, less than human in some senses. And I think those two things coming together really have led to this situation where we've seen increased political violence in the United States over the last 5 to 10 years.
You mentioned the availability of guns, also the idea of political violence. Can speech be controlled so that people will not preach political violence or act on it?
Well, I think part of it has to do with individuals and institutions, meaning that if there are political leaders out there, whether it be President Trump himself and sometimes his extreme discourse or other elected politicians on the right and the left, whose discourse is really less than civil, right? As well as the really new and availability of online media that is unfiltered, that is divorced from truth. Anyone can write anything and so on, including extreme allegations that have no basis in fact. I think unless those two things are addressed, unfortunately, this problem isn't going to go away. So I think part of this has to do with the type of leaders and the discourse that comes out from them, but also what people are reading and what is available on the internet in alternative news, quote unquote, outlets. That is not from professional journalists, not from reputable sources.
Samoshi Hata is the Associate Professor of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He was speaking with us from Washington, D.C. Comoros Islands authorities say the person who tried to assassinate President Azali Assoumani on Friday, September 13, is dead. According to Reuters, Assoumani was injured Friday in a knife attack by a 24-year-old policeman. Mohamed Saeed Changama is the CEO and the editor-in-chief of Heba FM Radio in Moroni. He tells me that President Assoumani is doing fine while the body of the attacker has been laid to rest.
First of all, the attacker was declared dead yesterday, Sunday, and was buried yesterday. The prosecutor in Moroni declared that investigators were to interrogate him yesterday morning, and they found him dead in his cell. The president, on the other hand, is said to be okay.
You said the authorities said the attacker died in prison. Did they say how he died?
The attacker was arrested on the spot and was taken by the president's bodyguard, security officers, to the presidential palace, where he was interrogated but didn't say anything. Then he was taken to the gendarmerie, sort of, you know, the police, you know, or military police, and the prosecutor declared to the press that the attacker was dead. No medical information was given. He was buried in his village. We have no report from medical authorities about the death, the reason.
There was tension in Comoros following the last election. Is it possible that the latest incident could be related to continuing displeasure about the last election?
Indeed, there is tension. There is no dialogue between the opposition and power. There are still prisoners, political prisoners, like the President Sambi, the former president, who is in life imprisonment. And there will be elections in December, January of this year. For the last month or of 2 months, there has not been tension as such in the streets. But for the last few, 2 to 3 weeks, we have been seeing parties, new parties, being declared, or at least through press conference. You can say that the situation, there is tension in the society because of many things, also because prices are very high. There are lack of commodities, you know, of, you know, basic food like rice, sometimes, you know, chicken wings and so. So the situation is tense. But despite that, there has not been like violence in the street as such.
Mohammed Saeed Chagaman is the CEO and chief editor of Heba FM Radio in Moroni, Comoros Islands. He was speaking with me from the Comoros capital, Moroni. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, September 16th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. It is day 7. The Maiduguri floods in Nigeria, which have rendered over 500,000 people homeless and about a million affected, as search and rescue teams continue operations. So far, about 29 camps have been erected across the state. Our reporter in Abuja gives us an update on the flood situation.
The camps in Maiduguri, Borno State, for internally displaced persons, or IDPs, are recording a high influx of people seeking refuge after the flood, which started on September 10, devastated the city. More people are being rescued and evacuated to the camps as the flood waters gradually recede. The Borno State Governor, Professor Babagana Zulum, noted that the flood has disrupted the social and economic activities of the state.
We have never witnessed such kind of floods in the history of Borno State, because I can say almost about 40% of the total landmass of Maiduguri Metropolitan Council and general local government areas of the states were affected by the floods. Thousands of people were trapped, and then within the last 4 days, both the civil population and the military and paramilitary are working out in order to rescue them.
The National Emergency Management Agency in Nigeria had assured residents of Maiduguri of intensified search and rescue operations. One resident, Uche Okoye, recounts his experience after the flood.
It was around 2 a.m. that we got the information, according to the sources of the people that told us that a flood has started coming to take over our area.
Meanwhile, President Bola Tinubu offered his consolations to the people and government of Borno and Zamfara states over recent floods and the death of over 40 farmers in a boat accident over the weekend. In a statement issued by his special advisor, President Tinubu promised to support the victims of the two tragedies. Maiduguri is facing its most severe flooding since 1994, with residents in Borno State on high alert as rising waters have submerged numerous homes. The flooding is reportedly due to the overflow of the Alao Dam, which has been filled to capacity for the past week. This is VOA News in Abuja, Nigeria.
Nigerian security agencies are hunting for dozens of escaped inmates from the flooded Maiduguri maximum security prison housing capture Boko Haram and Islamist State insurgents. Abubakar Mohammed Sani is security consultant with the University of Abuja Department of Military Studies. So viewers, Chinedu Ofor, that the city is vulnerable attack.
The threat level is now a bit high. Before this very jailbreak, we maybe 20-25. Now I would say it may be at 50-60%. And the possibility of Boko Haram launching an attack, coordinated attacks across some vulnerable part of the state is high. And it has taken us backwards. If because of these very incarcerated commanders, some of the operations of the Boko Haram people has been having some setback, when they are released now, they will go and they will strategize and plan very well and continue with whatever they're doing. So it's a setback even on deterrence mechanism. When you apprehend a Boko Haram commander, the jailing, it's part of the deterrence mechanism. Now they are out. And it's no more than a year that some other ones escape out of Kuje prison. So with this, it's a setback, and as I've said, it raises the threat level of the state.
Prior to this jailbreak, there have been questions about the ability of the Nigerian military and intelligence to cope with the onslaught of the Boko Haram. Now that they are out and with this flood situation, does the military have what it takes to not just recapture them, but also to secure the city?
It is my firm believe that the military, the Nigerian military, has the capability to secure the city. But you know, counterinsurgency operation is not just a military exercise alone. The Nigerian correctional service, those guys in charge of the prison service, the immigration, and especially the police, which the Department of State Security Services, they need to be on ground. At the moment, this jailbreak happened about 3 or 5 days ago. I've not heard what the DSS and the police are doing in apprehending this very escaped terrorist. But apart from that, the military on their own are trying. Even this very clothing, you see the way they have been up and doing rescue. So the military, they are trying. To the best of my knowledge, they are trying. Even the local community, we still know that many people are collaborating and aiding the terrorists with intelligence, with fuel, with food, with logistics. People are still doing it. Now, how will the military cope with that? When you move the military out there to protect you, you are the one who is aiding, collaborating with the insurgents. For whatever reason, God knows. So, but we can do our part. Other sister security agencies, the local community, I think we will make the work of the military easier.
There are also reports that the borders are porous and that some of these escaped quote-unquote militants and Boko Haram members may just slip out of the border and then slip back in when the situation stabilizes.
You're absolutely right. The borders are porous. It has been like this even before the return of democracy in 1999. It's porous, and that is why I was telling you the immigration service needs to be up and doing. The borders are porous. That is why even now the terrorists, they crisscross between Nigeria and the Niger Republic, Nigeria and Cameroon, and even Chad. It's easy for them to just look at any whatever and then they have disappeared. It's a major challenge.
Abubakar Mohamed Sani is a security consultant with the University of Abuja's Department of Military Studies, speaking with VOH Chinedu Ofor from Maiduguri, Borno State's capital. The government of South Sudan will brief diplomatic missions and United Nations agency on Tuesday after about his decision to extend the country's transitional period by 2 years. The government said the extension will enable it to implement the remaining critical protocols of the peace agreement. The extension also postpones the national election scheduled for December this year. Daniel Akech is the International Crisis Group's senior analyst for South Sudan. He tells me that the government will probably be explaining to the diplomats the logic behind its decision.
The agenda for that meeting has not been put out in public, so we cannot really tell what exactly the government will talk with the diplomats about. But what we could speculate is that this meeting is coming after a new event related to the extension of the transitional period, the 2018 peace agreement. So what we could deduce from this could be the government explaining the logic and how it will meet its obligations in implementing the peace agreements.
You and I spoke last week, and when we spoke, you were clear that the election schedule for the end of this year may not take place because of certain things that had not been done. Did you expect the announcement to extend the transitional period?
It was clear South Sudan was facing three conditions. Holding elections was one of them. Postponing election in two separate ways were the other two options. The event that just happened was also something we predicted, in that it was one of the three scenarios that we envisioned in that piece that we published on Wednesday. So we were not surprised that this came the way it did. What is shocking is the it's just like announcing it without really much explanation as to how this would be different.
I've been following the reaction on social media since the announcement was made over the weekend. I would say that the reaction is mixed, of course. Some people welcome it, while some are expressing, I would call it worried. They are not quite sure how extending the transitional period will lead to implementation of the key provisions of the peace agreement.
It's doubtful that there will be much of a difference between the additional 2 years and the previous 2 years. The reason for this doubt is that the economic situation is deteriorating. meaning that the government will not be able to find enough resources to fund the activities that they were not able to do. These activities, they include merging of the armed forces that have not been united up to now, also creating a legal framework, working on permanent constitutions and other election-related activities that the government was not able to do when it had ample time, it had enough resources at the time. Those are now not there.
You are in Kenya there, where the so-called Tumaini Peace Initiative is taking place. Do you think this extension could have an impact on the talks that are going on in Nairobi?
Yes, it will have an impact. It will be a negative impact.
Daniel Akech is the International Crisis Group's senior analyst for South Sudan. He was speaking with me from Nairobi, Kenya. It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport in Kenya, where the Confederation of African Football President Patrice Motsepe has said he is impressed by Kenya's preparation for the 2027 Africa Cup of Nations after a brief tour of the Moi International Sports Center, Kasarani, and the Talanta City Stadium in Nairobi. Motsepe is on a two-day visit to Kenya to review Kenya's progress in preparing stadiums for the 2027 AFCON. He will also attend CAF's post-executive committee press conference and will address issues pertaining to African football on Monday. Speaking at the Moi International Sports Center Kasarani, where construction work has been going on since December 2023, Motsepe said he was impressed with the work done so far, adding that he will make a similar visit to Uganda and Tanzania to assess progress made by the two countries.
There's a lot of engagement that will be going on between CAF and Kenya and Tanzania and Uganda. I must say, with all of us working together, we will really make African football amongst the best in the world.
And on to chess, where Team Nigeria is participating in the 45th FIDE Chess Olympiad Budapest 2024, taking place in Budapest, Hungary. The Nigerian quartet will vie for honors in different categories of the event, which started on September the 10th and will run through September 23 in the European nation. Notably among them is Nigerian chess prodigy Deborah Quickpen, a wildcard entrant who was recently awarded the Woman Candidate Master Award by FIDE. The 13-year-old Nigerian champion will be one of the players to watch it for in our age bracket at the event. And now to basketball, where Mali secured their third FIBA Under-18 AfroBasket title after beating debutant Cameroon 60-51 points in Pretoria, South Africa. It was Mali's third Under-18 AfroBasket over the last four editions of the tournament, having won it on home soil in 2018 and Cairo in 2020. In the third-place game, Senegal survived a Morocco scare, winning by just 1 point, 72-71 points. By reaching the tournament's final, Cameroon and Mali claimed the two tickets on offer for African countries for the FIBA Under-19 Basketball World Cup 2025 to be held in Lausanne, Switzerland. In athletics, Kenyan Sebastian Sawe won the Copenhagen Half Marathon, a World Athletics Gold Label Road Race on Sunday in the time of 58 minutes 05 seconds. The 29-year-old set a new personal best time. Taking second place was current world record holder Jacob Kiplimo of Uganda, who came in 58 minutes 09 seconds. And in third was Kenyan Lasoy Isia in 58 minutes 10 seconds. And that's it for this Monday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good Monday. And that's it for this Monday, September 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for beginning your week with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barty, Washington, wishing that you will have a great week.